This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Greg Wood, the Chief Financial Officer of Energy Solutions. The company is the country's largest nuclear waste firm and employs more than 4,000 people. The United States has just three commercial landfills for nuclear waste. An Energy Solutions site in Utah's west desert of Tooele County is the nation's busiest. Prior to going private in 2013, Energy Solutions reported revenues of just under $2 billion. How to store nuclear waste and where to do it remains one of the nation's most hotly debated topics, and rightfully so. One aspect that we can all agree on, however, is that if the country is going to generate nuclear waste, we absolutely need to handle that waste with the utmost security, the utmost care, and the utmost diligence. We want the companies doing this work to be financially healthy and run by strong professional management teams. Today's show will focus mostly on just that, the business aspects of this industry and the personal journeys of one of the company's senior executives. Greg Wood, thank you for joining us this morning on The Bottom Line.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
So let's start. I know nuclear waste, it has a very scary connotation, just the very term, but nuclear waste is classified into three or four major areas. Tell us what those classifications are and what type of nuclear waste Energy Solutions works with.
Sure. Well, we deal primarily with what's called low-level radioactive waste. And within low-level, there are Class A, B, and C waste. The waste that we dispose of, you alluded to our disposal site in the Utah desert. We only dispose of Class A low-level radioactive waste, which is the lowest level of waste. And to give you a feel for that, our employees at our disposal site, they're wearing boots, baseball caps, you know, normal clothes, jeans, et cetera. They're not wearing hazmat suits. But having said that, we're monitoring the radiation exposure that they have on a daily basis and keeping track of that. Our typical worker gets less exposure to radioactivity in a year than an airline pilot, for example.
Yeah, I think that surprises most people. Is that because of the containers that the waste is held in? How is the waste stored?
Well, different ways. Some of it's in containers. Certainly, the stuff in the hotter end of the spectrum would be stored in containers and shielded with concrete and stuff. But the vast majority of the waste that we take is concrete, dirt, things with very, very low activity levels, where you could go out and walk on the landfill and not have any negative effects from that.
Interesting. And where does this Class A waste come from? What's a typical use? Where does it come from?
Sure. There are approximately 100 nuclear power plants in the United States. On an annual basis, they're generating a certain amount of operational waste. That would be things like the uniforms their employees wear. Sometimes they have to switch components out of the reactor buildings. Those have radiation. Those have to be disposed of. So there's what we call the operational waste. And then there's with the aging fleet of U.S. reactors, they're starting to take them down. The average age of a nuclear power plant in the United States is nearly 40 years old, and those were originally designed for a 40-year operational life. And so as those have aged, they get more expensive to maintain. As energy prices have come down the way they have recently, there's more incentive for the utilities to take down those plants. And when they take down the plants, you can imagine that's millions of cubic feet of waste that needs to be disposed of.
Yeah, I think most people are surprised to be reminded of the fact that these nuclear power plants have been with us 40 years. It's really not new technology. I mentioned in the open that if we as a nation are going to decide that we're going to use nuclear energy, if we as a nation, another use is nuclear medicine, I would guess you get some of that waste as well. then we absolutely have a duty to store it as securely and safely as we can. As you look at how the nation got into nuclear power generation, do you think we had a robust enough conversation on the front end early on to make that decision?
Absolutely not. If you've read any of the stories about the Manhattan Project, when they came up with the first nuclear bomb in the 40s, there was such a drive to get to that result that I believe waste was really an afterthought at that point. And, you know, decades later, we're still dealing with some of that original waste from that original research that was done. So the answer is definitely no. What's interesting, I'll draw a clear distinction between the government side and the commercial side. So the utilities, when they open up their nuclear power plants, take a portion of every ratepayer dollar and set that aside into a fund that's invested for the ultimate closure of that facility. And so as we sit here today and there's announcements of closures of nuclear plants, there are billions of dollars already set aside in funds.
Which I didn't know that, but I'm happy to hear that. Yeah. I think the public is as well.
Right. And those funds can only be used. It's all kind of controlled by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and those funds can only be used for the decommissioning of that power plant. But, you know, the market that we're addressing as a company is largely kind of already funded for the work that needs to be done. And that's the case on the commercial side. Unfortunately, on the government side, which is all under the supervision of the Department of Energy, those funds are not set aside. And so there's decades of kind of deferred cleanup that needs to be done where there's just not sufficient funding to deal with that.
It's funded in a manner similar to your Social Security reserves and my Social Security reserves, unfortunately. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Greg Wood, Chief Financial Officer of Energy Solutions. You know, so the government has the advantage, obviously, of they get to print money. So if need be, there'll be the capital to do these types of projects. How do other countries handle the money needed for these cleanup projects?
You know, we don't do a lot of this work outside the United States, but in general, the nuclear industries, there's not such a distinction between commercial and government in a lot of those countries. So the government, most of the utilities are government owned. So the government directly or indirectly has oversight and supervision for that nuclear activity and cleanup.
So is my knowledge correct? France is probably the country that gets the largest percentage of its power from nuclear power. Are there best practices that France has developed that we are copying here in the United States?
Yeah, there's a lot of information being shared, you know, from country to country. Example of that, and we're sharing information with them as well. One of our big projects right now is decommissioning a nuclear power plant in Zion, Illinois, just north of Chicago on Lake Michigan. And we're about 6 years into what we think is going to be an eight-year project. Once that decommissioning is done, that shoreline will be returned to basically a shoreline park. So what was once a very big, ugly nuclear plant will be a park when we're done with it. And we regularly have, I'll call them field trips, of delegates from other countries coming to see how we're doing it and to learn. And so I would say in the industry generally, there's pretty good sharing of information. And certainly France is a leader in generating nuclear power, and we've learned a lot from them.
And I seem to recall stories of France in their early days not disposing of their nuclear waste properly. Is that fair to say?
Boy, that predates me, Doug. Okay. I mean, we're...
I seem to recall stories about, you know, dumping into the ocean and stuff like that, but I wasn't able to find it for the research on this.
Yeah.
So let's move on. You know, my undergrad's in engineering, and I actually thought about becoming an environmental engineer as a young person. I thought that'd be a nice career, help keep the environment clean. And I had a change of views in my first environmental engineering class at Purdue, which is a great school, but this is how environmental things were done 30, 40 years ago. The opening lecture of my environmental engineering class was, the solution to pollution is dilution. Which is a horrible thing, right? I mean, you still have the same amount of stuff going. A lot of the government regulations are parts per million, so if you can just put enough of the inert stuff in there, you can meet that mandate. And I just remember being so disillusioned by that. Is some of the solutions to what we're doing in nuclear waste, is can you dilute nuclear waste, or how is it regulated? Is Class A always Class A? Is Class B always Class B?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, at the point when we dispose of waste, I mean, this is such a tightly regulated industry that we're in. You know, every shipment of waste is tested at the site. There's a manifest put together. It's tested again when we transport it and bring it in to Utah. So there's really not a lot of playing around you can do, given all the regulation that we have.
Okay, excellent. You know, and so you guys have facilities, they're state-of-the-art facilities. I mentioned at the open, you know, we want to have the companies be financially healthy. We want to have professional managers like yourself and the rest of your management team operating these facilities. The reality is, where we put this nuclear waste is a huge debate. There was the Yucca Mountain, which was shelved in, is it 2012? Where is the hotter nuclear waste being stored? How are we as a country storing this waste now?
That's a great question, Doug. I would say as a country, we haven't done a great job of figuring that part out. By some estimates, we've spent $15 billion developing Yucca Mountain, which for people who are not familiar with it, there's a mountain in Nevada, southern Nevada, not too far from Las Vegas, which is one of the challenges, where they've built a very intricate system of tunnels, and
it's a very unique geology.
It
isn't
is,
it?
Yeah.
Granite, a lot of the type of stone that you would want to use, it just naturally occurs.
That's right. And so, the intent of Yucca Mountain was that we could take the high level waste, the spent nuclear fuel, for example, and store that in Yucca Mountain. But because for political reasons, after spending all that money, Yucca Mountain's never opened up. So what's happened today, which is not a great thing, we have radioactive waste and high-level radioactive waste stored all over the country. There must be hundreds of sites in the country where we have high-level waste. And that's all under the supervision of Department of Energy. They have responsibility for that. But each one requires very high level. It's very expensive to do it that way. Each site requires very high level security 24/7, and it's, you know, just not efficient, but also probably not great for national security.
Is a lot of this waste being stored on site where it was first generated, just because it's so hard to ship it? And where are they going to ship it to?
Yeah, so the commercial sites, the nuclear power plants, all have storage pads where they'll take spent nuclear fuel, they'll put it in these steel canisters inside these bigger concrete and rebar kind of reinforced cans, and then stored on B behind barbed wire and with security guards and stuff. And those pads exist all over the country. The DOE sites are areas like, you're probably familiar, Los Alamos National Lab or Oak Ridge National Lab, some of those big national labs.
Research facilities.
Research facilities have a ton of this stuff sitting on site.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Greg Wood, Chief Financial Officer of Energy Solutions. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Greg Wood, Chief Financial Officer of Energy Solutions. So before break, we're talking about where is the higher level radioactive waste stored. Unfortunately, a lot of that, as you mentioned, is stored on site. It's interesting, too, because these nuclear power plants are next to major metropolitan areas, as you'd expect, because that's where the power is needed. They also tend to be at some of the most scenic areas because they need access to large amounts of low-cost water for cooling. As you think about the current situation and Yucca Mountains off the table, and this is not a political show, but I'm just curious, what's your thoughts on what we as a country, where should we be heading to come to a resolution on this important problem?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think ultimately, and it's still a big capital outlay that would have to take place, but I think there are opportunities to begin to move some of that waste to maybe a few locations rather than having it in hundreds of different locations. That's something we as a company have been looking closely at. How do you transport it? How would you store it? Particularly in the case that Yucca Mountain doesn't open, we believe there's a nice solution to storing that in a few locations rather than in hundreds of locations.
So I talked earlier about, you know, me viewing the storage of nuclear waste as really a public good. I mean, we have an absolute duty to our kids, our grandkids, our great-grandkids, and millennials out to do this right. And I like the idea of the company. It's kind of a combination of we as a country need a defense department, right? We need to keep the country safe. We as a country need public, and these sound disconnected, but I'll blend them together. Need public utilities, because when we turn on our power switch, we want the electricity to work. And in the public utility case, it's really a cost plus model, right? Every year they get a monopoly, and every year they get to go to the government, or every two or three years, and say, well, this is what our costs are, and so we need a rate increase, and nobody wants a rate increase, but we all want the power to go on when we turn the light switch. So we as a society have decided that's a model that we support. You guys are privately funded. You're a private company. You really get no protection as a business, per se, as far as I can tell. Are the contracts set up in such a way that a private company can stay healthy for the decades and the amount of time that your company needs to stay healthy?
Yeah, we went public in 2013, as you mentioned earlier. We were previously public, and we're backed by a large private equity firm that's based in New Jersey called Energy Capital Partners. They've got about $13 billion under management. And one of the unique things about our relationship with ECP, when they took us private, we actually reduced debt, which is an unusual thing for a private equity firm to do when they buy a company. Usually they add a lot more debt and through a lot of financial engineering make their returns. But their view was, like ours, that we had too much debt at the time. And so we've paid down debt and we've put ourselves in a much healthier place to go forward. I do agree with you. These companies need to be healthy. I think both the utility side and the government side needs companies in the private sector who are solving a lot of these problems. And I think we've proven that it's difficult for the government to solve a lot of these problems. We certainly need that public-private partnership.
Well, we live in a state that a lot of folks believe in smaller government. And so if we're going to believe in smaller government, we need private companies to step up. I kind of put you on the spot on that question. I was actually the angle I was going at was more the nature of the contracts. Do they go into perpetuity? Do they have payments that come that line up with the amount of work and the costs that are going to be associated with handling this waste in later years?
They do. It's a terrific business.
And it should be. And I'm glad to hear that.
What's unique about us is that we have the largest processing facility. So some of the waste gets processed, either incinerated, metal melting, things like that, before it's disposed of. So, you know, we own the largest processing facilities in the country. We own the largest transportation fleet for transportation of radioactive waste, both trucks and rail cars. And then we have our disposal site here in the desert in Utah. So it helps when you have very unique assets. We are able then to, given the few options, we're able to establish contracts in a way that will not only benefit us today, but will also provide the long-term funding that we need to make that plant viable.
Right. You definitely do have unique assets. When I was doing the research, you know, I've known about Energy Solutions for a long time. I saw the revenues just before you went private were just under $2 billion. I was surprised it wasn't larger than that. How big is the nuclear waste business in the United States on the private side?
I'm hesitating a bit because it's difficult to define. So I'll give you one side of it. The Department of Energy spends about $6 billion per year maintaining all the stuff that they're responsible for, which is all the high-level waste. And most of that work is being – most of that $6 billion of work is being done by private companies. So private companies either doing work on site at one of the national labs, one of their weapons-making facilities. That's about a $6 billion industry. And I would say our part of that is actually quite small. Then on the what we call logistics processing and disposal side, which is where we have the unique assets, that's a much smaller market. The services to utilities, the private company services to utilities, would be a several billion-dollar market. The logistics processing and disposal piece of that is a small portion of that total market.
So here's my it's much smaller than I thought.
Yeah.
Which makes me feel really good, right? Because you could double, you could triple, you could quadruple what we're spending on waste management and making sure we have top of the line, we have everything that we need to do it right, and it's safe for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and really not move the needle for the federal government. So I'm delighted to hear that it's smaller than what I had originally thought. So we were talking earlier when I was asking about how the contracts are set up and whether the revenue matches some of the work that you have to do down the road. And you had mentioned the private equity firm in 2012 that came on board. I want to talk about that acquisition, but before we go there, I want to go back. How did Energy Solutions start? It seems like this would be a really tough business to get into, and I suspect it was kind of accidental. They were in a different business and somehow tangentially got into this. Is that correct, or was it from day one set up as a company to do this?
Well, back in the 80s, a gentleman here in Utah had the idea that the geology was right in the Utah desert to make a landfill for radioactive waste. And, you know, after many years of trying, and it's quite a long permitting process, as you might imagine, he was able to secure the permits to dispose of radioactive waste.
So he started from day one saying, I want a company that can store nuclear waste. The country needs this. Utah is uniquely situated, has the right geology for this. Boy, talk about a big, hairy, audacious goal. So that takes a lot of time. It also takes a lot of money. Did he bootstrap this himself from the early days?
He did. And it was a very successful standalone business. Ran it with a very small, you know, corporate headquarters. I think he made a lot of the decisions himself around contracts and pricing and things like that. And so he grew to a stage in the early 2000s. A private equity firm became interested in the business. A new management team came in, backed by a private equity firm. And they had a very different investment thesis than we have today. Theirs was there was going to be a nuclear renaissance. And so we're going to go out and buy a whole bunch of companies that provide a whole array of nuclear services. And that's what they did. And so from early 2000s up until the time they went public, which was around the 2007 timeframe, they bought up a lot of different companies. And I compare it to Frankenstein's monster. I mean, they just...
Nobody wants to hear nuclear waste and Frankenstein's monster together.
But, you know, they bought a lot of stuff, put it all together under a nuclear theme, and the public was very receptive to it. They had a successful IPO.
They were initially, right? They went public, as you mentioned, 2007, $21 a share. And this is all before your time. But that attraction quickly dwindled. It was a very challenging company to have in the public space. What do you think changed? What made it difficult to be successful in the public market?
Well, I think there's a few things. One, there that investment thesis that they sold originally, the nuclear renaissance, it became clearer as time went on that that wasn't going to happen.
We're seeing a change now in the biotech and the pharmaceutical industry. Who knows how it's going to play out, but it's a similar thing. 2 years ago, it was the darling of Wall Street, and now there's a lot of pushback based on some pricing that's happened and some things political candidates on both sides of the aisle have said. Now it's just out of favor. It sounds like that might have happened.
Yeah, I think that. I think certainly the recession in 2008 and 2009 had some impact.
Although probably no impact on your revenue and the company's revenues,
no,
right?
These are nuclear contracts. Plants are still generating. These are long-term, you know, contracts and the waste is still being generated. But it became clear in 2000 when I joined was 2012, and it was becoming quite clear then that not only was there not going to be a nuclear renaissance, but in fact, with energy prices coming down, there was more and more pressure to the utilities to tear down plants, particularly unprofitable plants. And so, you know, our investment thesis is this trend's going to continue, and
the decommissioning
of nuclear plants will continue, and that will generate a lot of waste that has to be dealt with.
So you came on board at a tough time. We mentioned the private equity buyout. That happened essentially when you joined, it was a public company. Shortly thereafter, went private, got bought out by a private equity group. And I want to talk about the personal aspect of that decision, but I want to wait till right now we're kind of focused on the business side. So when you joined, were they already looking for what boards would call, you know, strategic alternatives? Was that process already ongoing, or did that start shortly after you came on board?
That process had been started before I came on board. And in fact, just before I joined, the board had called that process off. that they'd explored some alternatives. Nothing had materialized. And so I think the board was deciding, well, looks like we're going to have to hunker down with the business for a while longer. And the board decided they wanted to make some management changes at that time.
And you were part of that.
And I was
management,
part of that.
Management change. So it's interesting you mentioned the Zions project outside of Chicago. Because at the press release, when it was announced that your private equity group was going to take you private, one of the partners from the private equity group used that as an example of why being a privately held company with the backing of this firm, this private equity firm, would be helpful. That contract had not been decided at the time, and he used that as an example of they think it increases your likelihood of being able to get contracts like that. Obviously, they were right. So I can see the advantages from gaining new contract side of it. What about operationally for you? You've been a CFO of a public company before. What were some of the major differences between being a CFO of a public company versus being a CFO of a company that's part of a private equity portfolio?
I think the biggest difference would be the level of involvement that the private equity firm has. And our board today is made up of David Lockwood, our CEO, and then four members from the private equity firm. And they're intimately involved in the business. I would say we have frequent calls with them. A public board is very much, there's a pretty clear division of responsibilities between the board and the management. You're often driven by the SEC filing calendar as to when you have your meetings and things like that, all your SEC filings and stuff. So it's quite different. I appreciate the guys that we have working with us because they have a passion for our business just like we do. They're very actively involved in the business, and we appreciate that.
You know, it's funny. I think in general, in the general public, private equity gets a bad rap. For those of us in the business that have worked with some of these guys, oftentimes some of the brightest, hardest working, dedicated people you know, done right, they can make a lot of money, and they should. But you know what? It's not a layup. It's a lot of work. And so I can see we're working with a team like that has a lot of advantages.
It does.
So when the buyout offer was announced, the offer was for $3.75 cash per share. Oftentimes you get, you know, some stock, but this was what they call a clean offer. It was all cash. At the end of the day, the stock closed that day at just under $2.75. So a dollar, almost exactly a dollar discount, which on a percentage basis, it's like, you know, a 30% discount off of the final price, a 40% premium off of where it was. That tells me the market did not think that the deal was going to close. Why do you think there was so much doubt that the deal would close? Obviously, it did close, so it's good news. And the people that didn't invest, they left money on the table. They could have made a nice return in a short period of time.
Well, and in fact, in the end, we closed at $4.15 per
share. In fact, their offer was, I think it was for 30 days or 60 days, unless you find a better offer, which you typically don't get private equity groups
right
there. Is that why it ended up bouncing above that?
Well, some activist shareholders got involved and made it clear that they were going to oppose the deal. Were very vocal about it in the press. And so, you know, ultimately, in order to get the deal, to ensure that we got a deal done, ECP elected to bump the price. But I think initially, yes, there was some, you know, question as to whether, how real it was, whether it was going to close. But ultimately, they ended up bumping their price.
Great. Okay. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more. Our guest this morning is Greg Wood, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Energy Solutions. So let's switch gears. Let's talk about your personal journey. And since we're talking about Energy Solutions, let's talk about that decision to join. You mentioned Dave Lockwood, who's the CEO. It was a management change. You and Dave, I think, came on board together, right? It was kind of a package deal. The new management team was announced simultaneously. The stock price dropped almost in half that day. Obviously, you know, when you have a management team that's been in place for a while, but that's got to hurt, right? You have a successful career. We're going to talk about many of those things. But, you know, you would hope that the stock price would go up. Well, great. Greg Wood is going to be here. How did that feel? How did you take that news? Did that impact you at all?
Not really. There were a couple. Any time a public company announces that they're swapping out the CEO and the CFO suddenly all at once,
I think it's a big risk.
Yeah, I think the market's reaction is, wow, what happened? How bad is it? And so I think that's just a natural reaction of the market. I think also that same day that we were announced, the company revised its guidance on earnings downward. So I think it was all that taken together.
Get all the bad news out all at once.
But yes, we have that great distinction of joining a company and then having the stock price go in half the same day.
So, you know, I ask because, you know, you've got a really strong career. We're going to talk about some of this journey. Let me just speak about, you know, some of the highlights here. Ernst & Young, so you're an accountant undergrad by training. You were with Silicon Graphics. Folks remember Memorex. When I was a teenager, Memorex was, if I could afford it, you know, pay an extra 50 cents for a good cassette tape. It was made by Memorex. Silicon Graphics, which was started by Jim Clark, who went on with Mark Andreessen, I forgot his first name there for a minute, literally invented the internet as we know it today. So some really exciting companies, also Steinway Music. I'm curious, what was your first reaction when you heard about the Energy Solutions offer? And, you know, let me just lay the groundwork, and I should have shared this earlier. You and I have known each other since you moved to Park City. I think you've been in Park City now 3 years. We've been friends. Thank you for coming on as a guest. And I'm interested in these inflection points. And I know as I get older, you know, I'm 52 now, I think about things as kind of chapters in my professional life, chapters in my personal life. This may be, may not, but it could very well be the last chapter of your professional career. How did you decide this was the opportunity for that chapter?
Well, it was a really tough decision, to be honest with you. I was with a software company named Actian in Silicon Valley.
Living big data in, analytics, right?
Big data which is analytics, really hot right area. Living in Palo Alto, which is a pretty great place to live. And I get a call one day from David Lockwood, who's been a longtime friend. David and I have, I guess this is about our fourth company together. So we've worked on and off for about the last 15 years together. And David was on the board of Energy Solutions. And when the board asked David to step into the CEO role, he said, well, I want to bring my CFO with me. And so David calls me. It was, I think, early June 2012. He says, got this great opportunity in Utah, but you got to decide in about a week. And I was right in the middle of fundraising for my previous company. We were about to go out and buy another company and was fundraising for that. The timing couldn't have been worse to get that
as is usually
phone call.
The case.
Right. And I think what did it for me was a couple of things. One is it's the people you work with. And David and I have had a great partnership for a lot of years. And I knew what I was getting into with him. And I like – like I said, we've had a great partnership, and I like working with him. But Utah was an interesting factor in the decision. I love to snow ski. I love the mountains. My wife and I have been coming here to go skiing rather than skiing in California because, you know, it would take 6 hours to drive to Lake Tahoe from Palo Alto.
Plus, we have the greatest snow on Earth.
And you got the greatest snow on Earth. So, and as you said, I'm older than you, so... you know, as you're thinking about, gosh, where's this, you know, what is that next chapter? Where might you live when you retire? Things like that. We'd actually talked about Park City as a possible retirement location. So when David calls and, you know, it's Utah, not some other horrible place, it just kind of fell together. And it felt right, and thrilled to have made that decision.
Well, we're glad to have you here. So we talked to a lot of guests, a lot of entrepreneurs that have built their company in after 7, 10, 12 years of hard work, are starting to be very successful and are now trying to recruit outside of the Bay Area. And I think a lot of companies are facing this hurdle. What were some of the things you were most concerned with, and what were some of the most attractive parts about considering Utah?
I was pretty familiar with Utah because we'd been coming here skiing and stuff. So from the personal aspects of it, you know, all that wasn't such a big deal. The business, you know, I was always impressed with the business community here. I think it's, you know, the economy's been strong. You know, the state's debt rating is fantastic. You know, all these spoken like a true CFO. Also, though,
your kids are grown, so you know the Bay Area can be a tough place to raise kids. So that, I think, for a lot of people is an advantage of Utah, mm-hmm. but in your case, that stage had passed.
Yeah. But, you know, I think I was ready for change, I guess. And, excuse me, the Bay Area was crazy. You experienced some of that yourself.
I left on purpose as well. And the big thing, I was at the other end of the equation. We were starting to think about raising a family. And I was just concerned about raising – I loved it in the Bay Area. You know, it was just 24-7, really interesting people, very ambitious. But it's 24-7 that. It's 24-7 your career. What I love about Utah is you can have a very interesting career, a very challenging career, but then 20 minutes outside your driveway, you can be skiing and you can – I'm a better person in Utah than I am in the Bay Area. For me, it's good to have something systemic that gets me to exercise both parts of my passions, the professional side as well as the non-professional. Yeah. It's also, I love our the fact that the legislature is so business friendly. If you have a business idea, if you'd like something for the legislature to consider, it's very possible to get it on the docket. I mean, you'll have to wait 11 months now to do it, but you can do it. The one of the things I was hoping you'd mention, just because I'll get on my soapbox here, we absolutely have to do something about the air quality here. I mean, absolutely. The last couple of years has been okay. But in the peak, it's our air quality is as bad as Los Angeles, and that should absolutely not be the case for one of the most beautiful states in the union.
It's unbelievable. You know, I'll wake up like you do on these bluebird days in Park City, and you start driving down the hill and you get to a point in the canyon where you can kind of see through, and there's just this gray line there. And
although driving down from Park City, I'll share with you what some of my friends have told me, which is it's you people commuting and putting all those miles on your car. And you know what? There's some truth to it. So shame on me. And there's probably an electric car in my future to help address that guilt. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Greg Wood, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Energy Solutions. So you were with a big data analytics firm, which was really on the beginning edge of what has now in hindsight turned out to be a huge wave. I suspect you saw that at the company. And you left to join that company. You left Silicon Graphics, which really their claim to fame was the most powerful computer you could get really in a desktop type situation. Now, I went to business school in the Bay Area, and when I was there, so it was mid-90s, Silicon Graphics was kind of the darling. Jim Clark, wildly successful. It always struck me as an unusual company because I've never liked the dynamics that technology is catching up to your differentiator. Do you think there's some truth to that, or what was Silicon Graphics like, and how did they stay on the cutting edge to support the premium that they'd have to charge for a high-end computer?
Well, they did for a while. But they faced a decision that a lot of technology companies face, and that is, do I make a shift in a different direction at the risk of cannibalizing by the rest of my business? And but if you don't make that shift, you risk, you know, other technology overtaking you. And frankly, that's exactly what happened to them. They were enamored with selling $20,000 workstations, if you can imagine, right? I mean, with all the technology we have today, you've got more on your laptop than, you know, these $20,000 workstations had back then. But they were so enamored with that that when the software-driven solutions were coming up, and they had the technology, they had the people, they had the know-how, they didn't make that shift because they were concerned about losing those $20,000 box sales. And
Where is Silicon Graphics today?
They're still a publicly traded company. Their focus is away from the graphics workstations and the whole graphics market. Their focus today is on supercomputers. So they sell
still the high-end computer side of things.
Very high-end computer processing, but it's a fraction of what it once was.
You know, people will be surprised, but Pixar's background back in the day was very similar to Silicon Graphics, right? They were really high-end computers specifically for animators. And they tried to get animators to come up with these full-length feature animations. And what they found was their sample videos, their sample animations were better than anything that the market was doing, and they developed that expertise in-house. Ultimately led to Steve Jobs being the largest shareholder of Disney stock when Disney purchased Pixar. So those pivots can be incredibly valuable. What was Silicon Graphics like when you made the decision? Was it still kind of a darling of the space, or could you see that, you know what, their space was getting much more challenging?
No, when I was there, we were much more on the back end of that success. And so we faced some of the challenging decisions, strategic decisions. Where do you spend the R&D number dollars? You know, which markets do you pursue, given that you don't have the vast resources you once had when you were making those decisions?
What do you think you took away from that experience of being in a business that is getting more competitive and more challenging every day?
Well, you got to be real, for one thing. It's easy, particularly in Silicon Valley, to get caught up in the hype and start believing your own story. Now, hopefully some of that story is true. But there's very clever marketing people that come up with, you know, great analysis you know, what opportunities you're going to go after and what portion of the market you can capture. So I think number one is, you know, you got to be real in terms of what you have to offer, what's the market you're addressing, and things like that. And don't always believe all your marketing stuff.
It's good advice. There's never is a long time. But do you think you would consider in the future working at a company that is kind of in a similar stage, maybe on the back end of its growth cycle?
I've actually spent a fair amount of my career in that position. You mentioned Memorex earlier. Memorex was a similar—
It was in the 90s, and so things were starting to slow down for them as well.
And so I just think it's having gone through that experience a couple times— you kind of know what to do. And so definitely I'd consider something like this. I still miss the tech stuff a little bit. I really do. I still dabble a little bit. It's been fun the short time I've been in Utah. I go out of my way to meet some of people in the tech industry in Utah. I find that, you know, lunch and talking tech for a little bit, even though I'm not an engineer, but I lived a long time in that world, there is a lot of energy in technology and new ideas. And I love some of this stuff that's going on here in Utah.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, you and I are friends. You know, for the last year, I've been teaching myself how to code and how to program. And it's intellectually stimulating, but it's also a lot of fun, just the relationships, the people I have met through doing that. So after Silicon Graphics, then you went with the analytics, the big data analytics firm Acteon. How did you find out about that opportunity, and how did you decide that was the right opportunity for you?
You know, that was through a recruiter in the Bay Area, and I guess I find at this stage of my career, the people such an important part of the decision and the dynamic. And you know, I met the CEO. He and I really hit it off. Got to meet some of the other executives in the firm. And I love the space. I mean, I think the big data analytics is a very exciting space. There's some companies here in Utah addressing that now, which is cool.
This is 2010 when you were joining.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of people were still trying to figure out what big data was, let alone the next iteration, which is really, what do you do once you have this big data?
That's right. Yep.
Was this a space that you knew was hot and knew was going to be one of the next generation industries that would be important?
Yeah, I mean, that part was pretty clear. I think the challenge was, if you think about it, there's sensors on everything now, right? So much data is being collected all over the place. You know, there's sensors on the bottom of the ocean collecting some kind of data. There's in your car, there's lots of sensors collecting lots of data. So with all that going on, the question is, what do you do with it? And that was really the challenge that I think we're still a long ways from solving. I would say, you know, some of the retailers have done a pretty good job of capturing customers' buying habits and suggesting special offers and doing suggestive selling and things like that. Certainly, when you give the Smiths guy your Smiths reward card, there's
a missed opportunity. I mean, they have all this data on us, and yeah. I've yet to figure out what they're using that data for.
Because,
like, you know, my kids haven't been in diapers for a decade, but I still get coupons for diapers. So they definitely need some big data analytics. So when you joined Energy Solutions, so you left Acteon, you joined Energy Solutions, and if I'm reading your profile on LinkedIn correctly, you also accepted a job on the board of directors of Steinway Music. When you're starting a new job, it seems like a tough time to take on an outside directorship. Is there something I'm missing there? Did it make sense?
Actually,
are they connected somehow?
No, they're not connected. I actually joined the board of Steinway about a year earlier. So it was 2011 when I joined the board of Steinway. And Steinway was also public at the time. They needed someone to head the audit committee of their board. And so I had those qualifications and was asked to join the board. And it was a great experience to sit on the other side of the board table and, get to grill the CFO the way I get grilled on a quarterly basis.
It was nice
by
to turn the tables.
Board. It was kind of fun, but I learned a lot from that. Ultimately the company was sold. It went private in 2013. And the public directors all, you know, resigned at that point.
You know, it can be really insightful to be on the other side of the table and see things, in this case, from the board of directors, as opposed to as a CFO, you'd for years been giving reports. What are a couple of the big takeaways that you learned from that experience?
Boards are a lot of work these days, particularly public company boards.
A lot of responsibility.
So I would say that's one takeaway. You can't really anticipate to do a good job at it, to be diligent as you want to be. It requires a lot of time and effort. And there's also a lot of regulations these days. So, you know, going through it's painful at times, but going through your checklists and making sure that the the record of the board and the audit committee is you've done all the stuff that you needed to do to be diligent. So that was one takeaway. It's a lot of effort and a lot of sort of detailed work that has to be done. I think the other side of it is, I hope I was this way, but management works really hard in these companies. And I think as a board member, you've got to acknowledge that. I think management needs pats on the back sometimes too. And so I think being a board member that understands the business, has a personal relationship with the senior management people, I think that was really important to the success as a board member.
Yeah, you know, it's easy to forget. I'm on several boards, and you know that I before I got into wealth management, which is what I'm doing now, did private equity. I was an operating partner. It was my job to go in and work with the companies and help them achieve their goals. It's a lot of work, and I'll tell you, as an investor, as a board member, sometimes I feel guilty, right? Because you know what needs to be done, and oftentimes the boards I'm on are startup companies. It's a tremendous amount of work. They don't have a lot of resources. They don't have a lot of people to pull it off. And we as a board get to say directionally, here's where we'd like you to go. And then we get to go have our life. And that founder is in there working 16, 17, 18 hours a day. It's a tremendous amount of work. So having sensitivity to that is definitely something that I think has made me a better board member. And it's fun to hear you say that as well. Kind of wrapping up now, a couple last questions. I told you I learned something new about you today before we started the interview, which is that you have your law degree from University of San Francisco. What drove you? What made you, it's a lot of work to get a law degree. What made you decide you wanted to do that? And then looking back, you know, how has that experience been helpful to you professionally? Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew I wanted to do some kind of graduate study, but I was my wife and I have been married 37 years this year, and so we were young marrieds. I was working for Ernst & Young at the time in the accounting firm. We needed that income coming in, so I was looking primarily at evening programs, something I could work during the day and go to school at night. And I looked at the MBA path. I also looked at the legal path and ultimately settled on law school. I thought at the time I might want to do tax law.
Which would be a natural extension from what you were doing.
It would, from the accounting and that sort of work. But in 1986, they rewrote the tax code. And whereas if I was a true tax professional, I would have just embraced that as the biggest opportunity ever. And my response to it was just the opposite, which is I don't want to do this anymore. So, you know, I stuck it out through law school, got through. But by that time, I was a manager in the firm. I was enjoying my career, what I was doing. And so I decided not to pursue starting over in a law firm. And I'm glad I did. I'd say I enjoyed the business side of things more than the legal side of stuff. But it was a fabulous education.
I would think as a CFO, as a member of public boards, which you've done in the past, having that law background is very useful.
I'm reading contracts almost, you know, every day. So have the ability to look at a problem, analyze a problem, come to conclusions, that sort of thought process you have to go through, and they drill into you in law school is a
very
valuable skill.
Yeah, I chose to go the business school route, but I took some I was also interested in law, and I took some classes over at the law school. Completely different. I mean, very intense, very competitive. It's a tough route. You know, as I talk to people at the business school, and we've had Taylor Randall, who's the dean of the business school, and several other people from the University of Utah, you know, a lot of the young people that are going into business today hope someday to become a CFO. What would you tell them about that job that maybe you wish you knew when you were in your mid-20s, early 30s?
You know, I would say early in the career to get the as broad an experience as you can possibly get. And I was fortunate that way. You know, I worked in the accounting firm. When I left accounting, I was doing consulting work, doing merger and acquisition consulting work, still with Ernst & Young. I then had a chance to move into the treasury side. I then got to head up all of finance at Memorex back in the day. But I've had the opportunity to just do so many different things that I think have all collectively made me.
I think that's great advice. Yeah, the breadth of experiences. And sometimes the places you get that management consulting, working for a large accounting firm, that may not be what somebody had in mind when they decided to go to business school. But that breadth of experience, being able to get a number of unique experiences quickly, it's hard to do that at one individual company where management consulting, working for an accounting firm, investment banking, they give you those experiences. Yeah. I'm going to ask a couple more on that theme just because we were talking earlier. You know, this might be one of your last professional chapters. So we're talking about advice you'd give people that are just starting their book of professional experiences. What about like halfway through? You know, what do you wish you knew when you were, you know, 10 years into being a professional in the workplace that would have helped you for the following 10 years?
You know, I'd say the first thing is more personal than professional. I, like a lot of people, got caught up in my career early on and was very driven, wanted to make sure I was at every meeting I could possibly attend. And I would say I did that early on to the detriment of my family and my family time. And so that's an area where it's a tough balance. I would say I've been challenged with that virtually my entire career. And when I dig into something, I dig in. My wife will tell you, when I started snow skiing at age 32, I was like, that was it. And so I think that's one thing is finding that right balance early enough in the career. I actually think the millennials do a better job of this than we did when I was coming up.
It's still early in their careers, but I would agree with you at this point. It certainly looks that way.
Yeah. So find that right, you know, balance between personal and professional and not, you know, so many guys, and you and I know probably a lot of same people, they kind of figure it out too late. And some guys even start the second family and do it right the second time, but the first family sort of misses out, right?
It's a big cost to pay.
It's a huge cost to pay. So find that earlier rather than later in your career.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks that succeed do have this kind of intense focus when they get on things. And it can be hard to have that focus on your career as well as equal focus on your family, but it's important to figure that out. Last question, we were talking about, you know, one of your last professional chapters. That's a tough decision for people to make. You made that decision 3 years ago. You've been able to live through that. What advice would you have for folks that are thinking about their last chapter or two professionally?
You know, I think it depends a little bit where you are, you know, personally and financially and where your family is and all that stuff. I was fortunate. My kids were already in college. That was largely funded. So I think at that point, you've got a little more freedom to choose to do the stuff you want to do rather than feel obligated to do something because of the paycheck. And for me, that's, you know, who are you working with? Where are you working? I mean, I get to live in a place now where I don't have to bribe my kids to come and visit me because they love the outdoors and skiing and things like that. So I have grown kids that love to come and visit me here in Utah.
Well, that's great advice. You know, I think, too, having a sense of urgency for it, right? I mean, I can, you know, at 52, I can kind of see the day when I'm 60. It's not that far off. And frankly, I pause and I wonder, how did this happen? How did I get where I can see 60 so clearly in on the horizon? So time passes. So choose wisely. Make sure it's a conscious choice. So great advice. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Our guest this morning has been Greg Wood, Chief Financial Officer of Energy Solutions. Greg, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Doug.
Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, as always, Ross, for lining this up. You can hear my entire interview with Greg on our website, kcpw.org. You can tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.